Hello, and welcome to episode 128 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Bob Silverman, the U.S. Director of Muslim-Jewish Relations at the American Jewish Committee, the AJC. He's also the former Senior Foreign Service Officer and a former President of the American Foreign Service Association. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Jordan. Happy to be here.
So the first question I'd like to pose to you is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Well, thank you. How many hours did we... Because my whole career has been in public service. Mm-hmm.
I should say, except for my first 3 years of work after I graduated law school in the decade of greed in the 1980s, I was a corporate securities lawyer in Los Angeles. It's hard... However, even in that three-year period in the mid-80s, I was taking companies public, some of which provided public goods. If you see mailboxes, et cetera, which used to be a mail services.
The company so, mailboxes, et cetera.
Yes, I was the one that took them public. So even in that period, I did a couple good things, I would like to say, good ethically good things, like helping companies like mailboxes, et cetera. But for 27 years, I was in the U.S. Foreign Service, representing our country overseas, and I was involved in a lot of things that advanced the U.S. national interest, advanced international human rights, and did other good, positive things for the public. Mm-hmm. But in the last 10 months, almost 10 months period, I retired from the U.S. Foreign Service, and I joined AJC, as you accurately said, to be the first ever Director for Muslim-Jewish Relations. And in that sense, I'm very proud of what we've accomplished to date.
So what is it that you've accomplished to date as a Director of Muslim-Jewish Relations?
Sure. Well, I looked at this challenge of Muslim-Jewish relations. A lot of people said, good luck.
You know, that's are there Muslim-Jewish relations, and why is it
yes.
matter?
Yes, there are. And first of all, I had a focus not on internationally work, but here in the U.S.,
yeah,
where the two communities have some, but now as a result, I believe as a result of this initiative, I started to have a lot better partnership. But when I started last May, almost 10 months ago now, there were a lot of things at the local level. There were individual synagogues, individual mosques that had some exchanges back and forth. There are dialogue groups, traditional interfaith dialogues that are happening between, usually between, led by clerics, rabbis and imams, and in some cases university chaplains.
Yeah,
there is, and it's still a very powerful group, the Sisterhood of Salam Shalom. Hmm. It's a group of women who've come together, and there are now branches all over the U.S., mostly on the East Coast where it started. But branches all over the U.S. So there are dialogue groups, but those were all local things. They were focused on apolitical dialogues, if you would, just to understand each other better. And it's super important. I don't want to dismiss it or dismiss its importance, but there was nothing at the national level, at a robust level.
Right.
There were things between particularly the Reform Jewish movement and ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America, had some exchanges, but nothing intensive that I could see.
So it sounds like there's a premise that in order to work on Muslim-Jewish relations, I guess you might infer that one ought to improve Muslim-Jewish relations, which is to say that perhaps Muslim-Jewish relations have not been that great in the past. Is that historically accurate within the American context and historically accurate within the global context?
Yeah, I would focus specifically on the U.S. and not try to define the Middle East, which is its own set of issues, or Europe, which is a third set of issues. But just looking here in the U.S., what I saw when I started this job was some local contacts, community-based, but not that robust, and a lot of potential common ground. And I looked at it like I would at any other major public policy initiative. You have to have several levels working at the same time. You need, you do need local community-based activism, mm-hmm. grassroots, if you would, because it, and that, that's what makes it real to people, that they know if they're Muslim, that they have Jewish contacts and friends that they see regularly, that they do things with.
Mm-hmm.
And that builds the trust, and that's the critical element.
Why is trust important between these two religious groups?
Well, they haven't worked together much in the past, and there is a lot of misunderstanding of the other because of lack of contact.
Is there antagonism?
There has been, and there's I'm sure there still is. But let me just mention, so going back to my analysis, you need local-based, community-based organizing. But if it's only community-based organizing, then it's going to be limited because it's going to stay those who participate in it and maybe people who've heard about an interfaith dialogue. But it's going to stay relatively limited and therefore not as significant that it could be. So what I did is establish a national level leadership council of Muslims and Jews, U.S. Muslims, U.S. Jews, who work together, who are in the media, who are meeting members of Congress, meeting the administration, sending out messages that help provide more visibility. So you need both. You need a national group and you need local-based activism. And so I focused on what I thought was, to date, really the missing element, which was a national leadership group. And now we have that.
So what are some of those messages that you're conveying to Congress and administration?
So what we decided to do was not focus on just dialogue, getting to know each other. That's important. But the kind of group I brought together is a results-oriented, pragmatic group. It has business people in it. Five CEOs of Fortune 500 companies are in the group. Leaders, former politicians, people like former Senator Joe Lieberman is in the group.
Are all the group members either Jewish or Muslim?
Yes. They're all American citizens and all either Muslims or Jews. And so these people are not into kumbaya, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
They want to see results. And our group is focused on public policy results. So we have a domestic-focused agenda. Excuse me. And there is one key issue for us. We've decided not to have a laundry list.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of issues of joint concern of these two communities, and you know we could talk about a long list of things, but rather than do that, we have decided to focus on one issue at a time, make progress on it, and then perhaps cover others. But right now we've just started, and the issue that we've decided to highlight, to prioritize, is a very serious problem that needs more advocacy around it and more visibility, is the issue of hate crimes.
Hmm.
Or you could call it, and I prefer this name for it, because hate crimes has a certain pejorative sound to it, crimes against people of faith.
Hmm.
And so if you look at crimes against people based on their religion or faith, this is something of amazing concern, deep concern to both Muslims and Jews and others. And it's a rising problem. This is a problem that has seen a dramatic increase in recent months and recent years, and we feel that our group is a good one to tackle it.
So it sounds like Jews and Muslims have both been targets of crimes against people of faith.
Correct.
And so seeking to advance this issue, perhaps trying to prevent those crimes or make stronger reprisals against those who transgress and commit these crimes would be in the interest of both groups. So in that sense, it sounds like you've been building an interfaith coalition.
Right.
Is there anything that you're doing that's meant to improve relations between Muslim and Jewish communities in America, or is it more finding common ground and advocating for policy positions that benefit both communities?
It is more the latter, Jordan. This is a results-oriented group. And we feel the best way to build the trust and build the relationship between the communities is do things together in the public.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we're also getting to know each other and building trust in the process. But we looked at the dramatic rise in crimes against people of faith. And we just felt that it was time to address that. And let's form a coalition to do that. So we have. And how do we do that? So the first thing to know about crimes against people of faith is that it's on a dramatic upswing, and it's dramatically underreported. The FBI collects annual statistics, and you will not be surprised to know that American Muslims have seen the biggest increase. So in the year 2015, which is the last full year for which we have data from the FBI, there was a 67% increase in crimes targeting Muslims as Muslims. Jews, however, remain the single largest target of such crimes. The dramatic dynamism and increases in the Muslim numbers, but year in, year out, Jews are the target of more crimes against people based on their religion than any other faith.
So greater acceleration in the Muslim community, greater velocity in the Jewish community.
Well, standard, yeah, the higher numbers, absolute numbers, are with the Jewish community. There are more crimes of this nature attacking Jews than any other group. Now, so both groups are interested. Other groups are also affected. And it really affects our entire country because these types of crimes are not individual attacks as much as the intent of such crimes are not just to hurt an individual, but to really, it's almost like terrorism. These are crimes intended to impact a whole group of people, to make them fearful, and also to affect the entire society. So that's the intent of this type of crime. So we think there's a societal response to it, and this group is mobilizing to help with that. What are we doing precisely? We are, A, talking to members of Congress, seeking legislation.
What kind of legislation?
Well, and we don't have the details as yet because we're waiting for it to be bipartisan. But there are members of Congress who are interested in addressing the core problem, which is lack of reporting. We know these are dramatic under reporting of hate crimes. Against people of faith. But once you have a better sense for the real numbers, you can design good remedies to address them. But, of course, prosecution is critical. Within the idea of prosecution, the real priority is state level and local level. It's not the federal government that should or is really the main prosecutor. These are kind of crimes that are best handled at county, by county police, by state police.
So are you lobbying state legislatures or chiefs of police?
We are. We're starting that, and we think AJC, which has 22 regional offices all over the U.S., and its allies in this coalition are well-placed to do that in every state.
So if the top priority is to reduce hate crimes, and the top tactic is to increase reporting...
And prosecutions.
Yeah. And prosecutions. Well, one, the question is, would improved prosecution actually act as a deterrent to the committing of this crime, these types of crimes? And second, you know, you can't legislate that private for-profit businesses such as newspapers and broadcast journalism organizations actually cover certain topics.
Right.
Would you propose offering congressional grants to organizations that would cover this?
Well, that's a really good question, Jordan, and the answer is yes. Part of the solution here is better public awareness, including in the media. And so one bill that we're looking at that is very promising, it needs bipartisan sponsorship, would give federal grants for state hotlines to report hate crimes. And there are, in some states, but not in others, existing hotlines that you can call in if you see someone painting a swastika on a synagogue, which, by the way, there's been an explosion of that.
So you feel like there are plenty of hate crimes that are unreported right now.
We know there are.
And increasing the reporting will increase community awareness, garner more media attention, and will therefore lead to more prosecution, increased prosecution does lead to greater deterrence?
Oh, yes. There's no doubt. You know, the FBI has done some studies that all conclude there's been massive undercounting. Year in and year out, since the FBI has been collecting data on crimes against people of faith, starting in 1995, the numbers vary between 6,000 to 12,000 crimes per year. But studies show that the real numbers are something like 290,000 such crimes per year.
So 290 instead of 12?
Yes. So we know there's massive undercounting.
So more 50, than...
53% of such crimes are not even reported to the police.
20 times underreported.
Underreporting. Of those that are reported to the police, the vast, vast majority are mischaracterized or not looked at as crimes against people because of their faith.
So they're looked at as assault or rape or battery, but they're not looked as hate crimes.
Right.
They think it's a one-off individual attacking another
as
opposed to this is a person who's a part of a group who I hate.
Right. And it is harder. I mean, because a hate crime has an element of intent that needs to be proven. So it's understandable. And also there are ideological reasons. I mean, the state of Hawaii, for ideological reasons, opposes a category called hate crimes. And so they don't report any.
What are those ideological reasons?
You know, you'd have to ask people in Hawaii. So there are no hate crimes reported. It's not a category that they kept data for. In other states, like the state of Alabama, for other reasons, no hate crimes reported in 2015. And in the state of Mississippi, one hate crime was reported.
So
we know that there's undercounting. And by the way, it's not just in these isolated places. In the city of New York, studies show massive underreporting of crimes targeting people because of their faith. So we know that this is a huge problem.
So why does it fall to AJC to do this, especially when organizations such as the Anti-Defamation League or Southern Poverty Law Center or, you know, federal organizations like the FBI or local police departments, you might suppose one of the listeners could say, well, why not just let law enforcement do their job? Or there are other nonprofits in this area fighting against hate crimes. Why is it that what is AJC adding to this conversation?
Right. Well, good question. First of all, there's room for all of the above. I mean, it was just on the line with the Southern Poverty Law Center and its chief expert on this, a guy named Mark Potek, and he welcomes this this council that we've created. The Muslim Jewish Advisory Council is another tool to help on this issue. It's not in lieu of what ADL does, Southern Poverty Law Center. If you talk to the Department of Justice, Civil Rights Division, they welcome civil society's help in this. We need to be partners. A big part of the problem, again, is public awareness and helping communities understand each other. That helps prevent it. And the Department of Justice has embraced our initiative as we're working very closely with them on it. And so, yes, a big part of the solution is for the federal government to have a better partnership with state and local police that leads to better public awareness, better community relations to ameliorate conditions that lead to hate crimes, and prosecutions. And so, the federal government really is the backstop. The prosecutions, by and large, should be handled by the state and local police. And the federal government is there as a backstop. So we've started now a very good dialogue with the Department of Justice. We're starting to work with all the states and our other civil society partners on this. And I think we're going to make a big headway.
So, Bob, I'd like to transition a little bit over towards your 27 years as a Foreign Service officer. You started as a corporate attorney doing M&A or finance and mergers and acquisitions for our listeners. And now, and then you did almost three decades, a quarter century of representing the United States abroad.
Yes.
And now you're in this new work. To what extent did this, how did you make that transition from being a diplomat to diplomatically bringing together two different religious groups and advocating for civil liberties?
Well, it's a great question, Jordan. I think being a diplomat teaches you, you can learn this skill from other professions as well, but it really requires you to see the world from someone else's point of view. Because when you're overseas representing your country and you're working in Pakistan or Turkey or Sweden, I'm just mentioning places that I've served overseas, Egypt, you want to convince them that it's in their best interest to do help the U.S. in a policy, a certain policy. So how do you do that? You try to see the world from their point of view. And once you get inside their perspective, you will identify the common ground that exists between U.S. interest and their perspective.
How does one...
And so you have to start by deeply understanding, not superficially, but deeply understanding another person's point of view, another government's point of view, and that will help you identify where the common ground lies. And so I've done the same thing here. I've tried to understand, deeply understand, another community, which the American Jewish community has had to date a lot less contact than it should, the American Muslims, and with sympathy, but with no preconceptions either, you know, or no covering up of problems. Every community has its enormous problems. The American Muslim community is extremely diverse. It's the most diverse, which in all the good and bad senses of the word, it's very disorganized. There's no umbrella groups of any consequence, and it's a relatively young community.
Do most American Muslims even consider themselves to be American Muslims, or they consider themselves to be from Pakistan? Yeah. Or I'm more Sunni. I'm a Sunni. Why would I identify as a Muslim? Or I'm Shia from Iran. What do I have in common with the Sunnis from Saudi Arabia or Indonesia?
It's a great question as well. I would say there is an emerging identification as Muslims. There are whether it's Sunni or Shia, they do identify, I believe, primarily as Muslims. Now, there's also the ethnic and national origin identification. Sometimes they go hand in hand, sometimes they don't. So, for instance, a very large group of American Muslims are from India, where Muslims, of course, are a minority. Of course, they're a large minority. I think India is the second largest community of Muslims in the world after Indonesia.
Only because that used to include all of Pakistan when it was the British colony, and the Indian Muslims are those who were in the entire British colony of India who then did not migrate when the country's partitioned in the late
40s. Well, I mean, there are more Muslims in India than there are in Pakistan or Bangladesh. It's just a giant country of a billion plus. But in any case, the reason I mention that is so they identify both as Indians and also where they're from. If they're from Hyderabad, they identify it as a Hyderabadi. If they're from Kashmir Muslim, they identify as Muslim, an Indian, and a Kashmiri. So they have multiple levels, but that's familiar to us. If you're from Ireland, I suppose you could identify as a Catholic, you can identify as Irish, and you can identify from the county where you're from. You can be from Dublin, you could be from County Kerry or something. And you could identify various ways. Likewise, these people who come from Muslim countries overseas have multiple identifications, and they're not necessarily in conflict. And so, but what's emerging over time is a strong identification as Muslims across ethnic lines. That's relatively new. You still have the single largest group in the American Muslim community are the African American Muslims who have not immigrated in recent decades or years. These are people who have African Americans who've been here for centuries. They were brought over as slaves. They were they were originally, many of them, in the Nation of Islam and have converted to mainstream Islam. So it's a fascinating community, and they are the single largest group in the American Muslim community.
So we're approaching the end of the podcast, and I'd like to ask you two final questions.
Sure.
One is just to follow up on something you were talking about when you said you were a Foreign Service officer.
Yes.
You said a great deal of what your responsibilities were to convince the other countries to pursue policies that were in America's interest by convincing them that it was in their interest as well.
Yes.
And you said that you had to teach yourself to see someone else's perspective. Yeah. I imagine, if particularly in contemporary United States, many individuals may find it challenging to view anything from someone else's perspective. Can you provide our listeners with a little guidance on how to go about finding common ground with someone who's different than you, and how to really understand someone else's perspective?
Yes, it's a great question. I believe, I'm a firm believer in reading and understanding and listening to the other person. So when I started this job almost 10 months ago, I really didn't know anything about the American Muslim community. I knew I'd worked overseas and met many Muslims and worked in Muslim-majority countries, but the American community was something that was completely unknown to me. So I went around asking questions and listening. And now I didn't have to learn a new language. These people are all American citizens and speak English. Mm-hmm. So that was a huge... For me, it was relatively easy. I'm used mm-hmm. to doing this in places where I had to learn a foreign language, whether it was Arabic, Turkish, Azerbaijani, all these are languages I've learned, and in the course of my work overseas. But here, they're American citizens. I have a lot in common with them, just fellow citizens of the same country that we all love and cherish. So it was relatively easy, and now 10 months later, I feel like I have a good, pretty good handle on the American Muslim community. It's a fascinating very positive development, despite some of the scary things you read about. And so I would say, listen, ask questions and listen, and read everything you can.
So as we speak so much about listening as a means of understanding someone else's perspective, I'd like to ask a final question. If you could allow our listeners to hear what your motivation has been throughout the course of your lifetime in public service. You've now entered ostensibly your third career trajectory throughout your life, your adult life, and you've done a lot. You said you were able to help a company that you believed in go to an initial public offering on Wall Street. You mentioned 27 years in the Foreign Service, and of course your new role with the American Jewish Committee. Can you provide our podcast's audience an opportunity to listen to what it is that really has been driving you to advance the public interest throughout your career?
Thank you. I would say curiosity is very high up there. I was fascinated with the American Muslim community. I wanted to learn about it and how to do that. Listen to people, ask questions, read what you can, get out there, get away from your cell phone and computer, and go meet people. You learn a lot more by face-to-face meetings, I think, than you do by sitting back and reading something on the internet. You should do both. It's not one or the other. But it's much harder to go out and go meet people. And I did a lot of that to start off with. And I'm still doing a lot. I'm flying around, meeting people. And I believe in face-to-face meetings. I think you learn a lot more from that, and you develop a relationship from that. And it may be counterintuitive to a lot of people these days who really live on the internet, and I understand that. I'm on the internet, you know, sending hundreds of emails a day and reading articles online. So that it's not one or the other, but don't forget about the face-to-face contact. It's the critical element, and I think never lose your curiosity and your interest in others.
And that has been Bob Silverman, the U.S. Director of the Muslim-Jewish Relations at the American Jewish Committee, a former Senior Foreign Service Officer and the former President of the American Foreign Service Association, who speaks about his lifetime in service as one that is primarily predicated upon relationships, whether relationships between nations, relationships between individuals, relationships now between different faiths. He speaks about maintaining the importance of maintaining a high sense of ethics throughout the course of his public service and trying to promote dialogue. In fact, one of his primary priorities as the leader of the Muslim-Jewish Relations initiative at the AJC is to promote public awareness so that there is more dialogue between Muslims and Jews, between anyone who finds hate crimes or crimes against people of faith, as he calls it, to be despicable acts against which all Americans ought to stand together. He speaks that there's an underlying value of trust, a character trait of curiosity, and the importance of listening to someone else's perspective. Bob is a man who has been guided throughout his career by that natural curiosity and a desire to build trust, to build relationships, and through those relationships, to advance the public interest. Bob, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jordan.
And this has been episode 128 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Remember to subscribe at publicinterestpodcast.com on iTunes or on your podcast app on Apple products. And if you would like to leave a message for Bob, you can call the phone number listed in the Contact Us page of the podcast website, and that message will be forwarded along to him. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.